Good morning. First case is United States v. Jacinto.
Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Michael Lester, and I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Salvador Jacinto. Chief Judge Stuckey, respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
These allegations came down to one thing: the accuracy of her perception of what happened. 2 days after she made the allegations, her school counselor recommended that she be admitted to a mental health hospital based on reported erratic behavior. She remained there for more than 2 weeks. For months, the government told the defense that E.B. was not prescribed any medication and had no condition that would call into question the accuracy of her perception of what occurred. Before trial, the military judge ordered limited discovery of her prescriptions and her diagnoses. He waited, for reasons unclear in the record, until only 6 days before trial, before ordering the hospital to produce this information. When it arrived, the defense only received it about 2 business days before trial, and it contradicted everything the government had been saying. Contrary to what the government had been saying, the records indicated that E.B. had been prescribed a very serious antipsychotic medication to treat psychotic agitation, which is a condition that the defense expert explained can cause a person to suffer delusions, can cause a person to engage in aberrant behavior, and can cause a person to be stimulated by things that are not actually in their environment. Military judge abruptly denied, without any explanation, the defense request for a continuance. But then he did order the hospital to, in his words, decipher the records. He wanted to determine whether E.B. in fact took the medication. But he proceeded to trial before even having that clarification. The night before trial, the defense again asked for reconsideration of the continuance, explaining that it remained unknown why somebody put this in E.B.'s record. If he didn't take it, why was it there? The military judge responded with no legal analysis, simply, "Motion denied, see you all tomorrow." Separately, he denied the defense motion for in-camera review of the records, but his findings of fact indicate that it was an arbitrary conclusion. He said that there was no evidence that E.B. took the medication. But again, he didn't even wait before having an answer to that very question. He also wrote there was no evidence that she intended to tell her.
Where are we on this? On the, you know, I think it's further effort that she was prescribed this stuff. Thorazine. Where are we on this? Do we know whether she took it? Do we know whether the prescription was filled? What do we know?
Because we know that somebody...
He asked the hospital. Did the hospital respond?
There is no indication in the record that it did so, Your Honor. This order that the military judge signed was signed on the Thursday heading into the weekend before the trial started, which was Monday. And for all that we know on the record, the military judge doesn't even acknowledge signing the record. When the parties get on the record Monday of trial, the military judge makes no reference to his order, nor does he reference it in his written ruling on in-camera review, and of course his continuance ruling didn't have any legal analysis. So where we're left, Your Honor, is military judge indicating on the record, and I think this is a direct quote, "Are you saying that the defense should not be able to get into the fact that she has this psychotic condition?" And he actually said, "I wrote in all caps that she may have been seeing things that are not actually there." And so despite those statements, and despite signing the order, there was never any clarification of the matter before the trial began. His response was, with respect to the judge, a curt one of just "motion denied, see you tomorrow." And as I wrote in my brief, this court can't be convinced on a continuance motion without any legal analysis that the military judge properly considered all of the factors this court in Miller stated that can guide a military judge in that decision.
So leaving aside the question of what the military judge is going to do in any possible in-camera review, since he's not trained in medicine, I certainly think he can read, took it or didn't, but anyway, yes,
Your Honor. And so,
just so I'm clear factually,
The request for the continuance was made, obviously, before the request for in camera review. Is that right?
It was. It was kind of at the same time. It's in the record, the defense is saying we want more time. So I think there's a point in the transcribed record, and this is in the second volume of the JA, where he discusses, Your Honor, I want to get our position straight. We want the continuance, and separately, we want in-camera review. And so I think in that sense, Your Honor, the continuance did come before the in-camera request.
And the continuance, the need, at least from the perspective of the defense, was they needed the continuance at that point because their expert had raised this inconsistency in the records that had been provided him. In other words, and correct me, so that I'm clear to that. I have a JDF, my name, not an infant. But it seemed that the expert had seen a diagnosis for no psychotic agitation, but had prescribed medication that is used to treat someone with psychotic agitation. Is that the discrepancy that arose, at least from the defense expert's view, that prompted the request for the continuance?
So there was a discrepancy, in part, Your Honor. So the records did say, and the expert was clear, when the government said, well, aren't there notations in the record saying that she's alert and conscious? The expert said, yes, but I can clearly see in the records that the Thorazine was prescribed, reason, colon, psychotic agitation. And so that, in her mind, is what dispelled any notion that Evie did not have this condition. More to it, the expert pointed out to the specific dosage, which the government tried to get her to say that maybe this was taken for a non-psychotic reason. And then there again, she said, no, this dosage is very consistent with somebody who is having that condition. And then she also added that even with those notations, that in her view, that was a medical incongruity. You can't in one place say the person is experiencing a psychotic condition and not in any way document that in the note. And of course, the procedural history is important too, Your Honor, because we have in the record heavily redacted records. So we're getting snippets. We don't know who redacted those records, but it's enough to say the amount of information that was there was enough to signal to the expert that very likely Evie had this condition when she brought the allegations against the appellant in this case. And the government
also, the request for continuance was basically was it only to resolve that specific issue?
It was not, Your Honor. So there were really three ways of the defense articulating the need for a continuance. So the first reason was to figure out, this issue, right, that the military judge ordered the hospital to clarify. So that's issue number one. That would have given clarity and answered definitively, whether she had this medication. Second issue was the defense explained this as a bombshell on the eve of trial. I think that was a direct quote. They explained that they wanted to expand discovery requests. In the record, this is between JA 55 and 62, trial counsel seems to suggest earlier on that there's psychiatric records, perhaps at the school where Evie had gone routinely. But for months, the defense has been told that, oh, there's nothing that in her record that's going to cause any doubt on her perception of the event. So I think with more time, it's safe to say that perhaps in a similarly unprivileged way, the defense could have requested or at least spoken to the school psychiatrist, maybe with judicial intervention, to have some limited records uncovered as well. Of course, there's also the fact that the defense had a trial with 23 witnesses and preparing everything that goes into a trial that Your Honors are well aware of. And the military judge, despite that, says, you have the weekend to get this in order, and I'm going to deny the continuance. So there's really the preparation for the trial, Your Honor. That was a big piece of it. Finally, the third piece would go to the theory of the case. So the defense in their motion explained that the theory that they wanted, that the theory they believe this evidence could call into question and change the alter the theory of the case, they said. At trial, they largely focused on NCIS's sloppy work, as they called it, and they also talked about, perhaps Evie and JD, they couldn't be believed because they were lying. This was another strategy that the defense could have had that would not have resorted to that sort of argument. If she had this condition, it's very possible the defense, the entire fact was completely deprived of a theory that Evie had some sort of mental condition that caused her to act in improper ways that were not correct with her environment. And I think that's what moved this case into the realm of, okay, we needed more time. This was an injury to the defense's preparation of the case. More time minimum was needed because of the, so to speak, earth-shattering nature of this evidence.
Counsel, so I certainly agree with you that the military judge abused his discretion in denying the continuance. But given that the military judge also seemed to believe that much of this evidence was not admissible in any rate, what can you describe, what was the prejudice to appellant then of not having the opportunity to further explore and change your strategy because of this evidence? The evidence was never going to get in the first place.
Well, Judge Murray, I don't know that that's correct. I think the military judge did not make any finding that the evidence would be admissible. We weren't talking necessarily about, so that kind of gets into the second issue a little bit.
Right. I mean, in his written ruling on the motion for in-camera review, he certainly suggests that he thought it wasn't admissible. He didn't rule on it. But if that was his perception, and let's just assume if it wasn't at an end, what is the prejudice?
The prejudice would still remain, Your Honor, because the defense couldn't have found this information out from other sources. I mean, that's the point of the continuance. It was going to not only allow the piercing of the psychotherapist's basic notes, but it was also going to allow the defense more time to, again, explore parts of his case that it did not explore because of what the government said. The defense, so before trial, to illustrate this further, the military judge granted a motion in limine on JA 586, where the government said, let's just exclude all of this irrelevant mental health evidence. So we can't even mention, we could barely mention the fact that she was at the hospital. You know, we're not going to talk about any of her other diagnoses. And, because the defense, what they're going to do, Your Honor, is they're going to try to portray her as some loon who can't be, So that's the question that we were dealing with. At a minimum, a continuance would have given more time for the defense to sort of, like I said, step back and just reassess his case, maybe talk to relatives, schoolmates, people that would have had this close relationship with her. And so we wouldn't necessarily even have to deal with the issue that Your Honor poses of having to deal with the admission of potentially privileged records.
And so, as you've noted and has been discussed here, military judge made two key findings. One, there was no psychotic agitation. Two, no administration of authority. Those factual findings would stand unless they are clearly erroneous, and it's clear that you believe that they were clearly erroneous. Let's assume just for a minute, though, that this court were to determine that those findings were not clearly erroneous. What is the analytical framework that we should look at that, in your view, would cause a appellant to prevail on issue one?
Your Honor, the issue would still remain that the defense was still thrown off by evidence that, for whatever reason, right, somebody prescribed this, somebody wrote this in her records. The defense still needs to be able to step back and assess why this was. So the military judge, there's some cases out there that I think are on point, for example, in Wiesbeck, this court dealt with expert testimony, right? This court didn't get into the weeds of, what exactly would the expert have done and what did it cause the defense to prevail at trial. Rather, the court focused on just the abrupt denial, the arbitrary insistence on speed at the expense of giving the defense enough time to prepare and present its case. And I think, as the military judge seemed to indicate on the record, Your Honor, and if we were in this thought experiment, assuming that he did not clearly err on those facts, he even admitted, government, do we not still have somebody writing this in her records? And so, what that can't be undone, Your Honor. The fact that the doctor decided to do this, the fact that this evidence about her mental health became an issue that the government had been saying it wasn't, that still required more time for the defense to be able to look at.
But why? If the military judge has concluded this is much ado about nothing, there is some type of errant notation in the medical records reflecting this, but I have made a factual finding that there's no basis to believe that E.B. had experienced psychotic agitation or had actually been administered the Thorazine, why wouldn't this issue completely dissolve in the air?
It wouldn't, Your Honor, because I kind of understand the previous argument. Just the idea that we're dealing with the defense being told for many months not to consider this evidence. The military judge has some discretion, Your Honor, but the idea being that there's two suppositions in there. The defense has notice and has the opportunity to be heard on this issue. And I think even with military judges' findings there, we were still left with an unfair trial because the defense was still not able to investigate this matter further and was not able to, again, explore a theory that could have been potentially presented apart from the military judge's findings of fact.
Counsel, may I ask you a question about the wording of the military judge's finding of fact? He didn't specifically say, I find she didn't have psychotic agitation, and I find she didn't take Thorazine. He said there's no evidence. And to say there's no evidence is, you know, there's some indication, perhaps, in the record. And so my question is, do you agree that that's what he found, that she didn't have psychotic agitation and that she didn't take Thorazine? And then secondly, what would be necessary to show those findings are clearly erroneous, just that there was some contrary evidence or that there was evidence that she actually did, that it's just clear that she did have psychotic agitation and did take the drugs? Do you understand the question?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. So I think there is, so it's kind of both. There is evidence that she had this. So to say that he said there is no evidence, not that both sides presented compelling evidence on this, and it was a very close call. He is saying, Your Honor, and this goes to Judge Olson's point, that there is no evidence that she had this condition. To reach that fact would be to ignore all of the expert testimony that was presented, that the government didn't meet with its own expert, and also what the notes that were written in her record indicated. And mind you, Your Honor, there was also evidence around the corners, so to speak. We had evidence in the record of erratic behavior. The military judge did not allow the defense to get into a trial. So, for example, the seminal event that causes her to go to the hospital, with, you know, I didn't get into it more than that, but there was a drug allegation that she then told her mother didn't happen. That wasn't even allowed to get into a trial. So it's not as if, so that evidence was before him. So I think it's fair to say, Your Honor, and then this goes to your first question. So there was evidence contradicting it. I think his ruling is to be read as he did not have this condition. Because when you read his ruling, he says it's completely off bounds, it's going to create some trial within a trial. I think that conclusion can only be drawn if he is thinking that I find that there's no evidence that she had this condition. I think, too, he reached that his findings based on crediting the government's claim that, you know, it was listed as needed. And he thought, well, it wasn't as needed. So therefore, I think that provides additional evidence that he thought that there was no reason that she had this condition in the first place.
So to determine that he was clearly erroneous, we have to say, look, the evidence is overwhelming that she did have this condition?
No, I don't think you need to go that far, Your Honor. I think it's enough to say this was an arbitrary, I do see I'm running out of time. Thank you, Your Honor. I do think it's enough to simply say that he arbitrarily assumed facts that were not there, that were in front of him, strongly suggested that very likely is the testimony of the expert. And he acknowledged on the record there was strong reason to believe that she had this condition, to the point where he was almost going to allow the defense to cross-examine her on it. But then he decided on his own, without waiting for something that he said was critical, that you know, there's no evidence that she had this condition. We think it's enough for this court to say that that was an arbitrary act that went against the weight of the evidence that was in front of him, and that's enough under the court's precedence to constitute an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Judge Oldsmith.
Yes,
sir. I'd just like to dive a little deeply into the state of the record in front of this court, make sure that I've seen everything that I need to see here. Now, the defense forensic psychologist testified at the 39A, and the indication from the military judge was that the psychologist had reviewed the records that were marked as Appellate Exhibit 71, Roman numeral 71. But I don't see that in the joint appendix. Am I missing something?
You are missing something, Judge Olson, and I alluded to this in my brief, that it appears as if there were notations that, if I may say, the government tended to cite more than the defense did in its brief. I mentioned them earlier that, you know, she's alert, she's cognitively focused. But again, we don't know where those are coming from. There does seem to be documents that are out there that were never attached to the record for reasons that are unclear at this point. But even with those records, they were explained by the expert at 39A, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, the military judge issued the June 8th order for the medical records.
Yes.
Are those here?
Those are not here, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, with the June 14th order directing the hospital to produce the records, did the hospital ever respond?
And that's the answer in the negative, Your Honor. They did not. Because we have here, in the defense continuance motion in the joint appendix, they say, I forget the page number exactly, but they say in the continuance motion, it remains unknown why this medication was prescribed. From that, we already gather there was no follow-up with that, Your Honor, as well as with the fact that this order was ordered to be produced at the last minute. I mean, this was like heading into the weekend before trial, essentially.
Now, separate from the last part where it doesn't appear as if those records were ever produced, is this court hampered in its appellate review of this case because of the state of the record?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think the reason is this, that whatever records the parties chose to present at that 39A closed session, those are attached to the motions there. And to the extent that there are missing records, it seems to be very minimal, and it seems like those were explained through the testimony of the expert. I mentioned, how the government said, well, this note here seems to say this, and then the expert responds to it on the record and explains in terms of, in her words, it's a medical incongruity. And also that, it could mean that the medication is working now, and that's a very common procedure, right? You say the medication is working now, she's alert and so on and so forth. So I don't think that we're in a situation where this court has no ability to rule on this issue. I think the relevant evidence to this issue was presented before the military judge and the court below, and that's enough to say that there's a sufficient factual record here, Your Honor.
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Clayton Wiggins, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Nate Gannon, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge did not have the authority to grant in-camera review of the victim's privileged mental health records. And second, Rule 513 is not unconstitutional as applied to appellant's case. And with Your Honor's permission, I'd like to briefly recap the factual background. I know that the judge Olson's point at the end there is perhaps some confusion in the record before turning to the granted issues. And so if we look back as far as 7 months before trial, at the preliminary hearing in December of 2017, we know from the record, especially from Full Exhibit 12, that the appellant was on notice of a few things. One, that the victim had gone to inpatient treatment. And two, that she had been there for approximately 2 weeks, 1 week of which was inpatient, 1 week of which was outpatient. The appellant, rather, also received evidence at that December preliminary hearing from the mother's interview, Your Honor, that the victim had been given two medications. Ultimately, those ended up being the same medications that we know she was given. And this is also diagnosed with two mental disorders, not ones that included psychotic agitation. So that's 7 months before trial. And if we fast forward, Your Honors, to April 25th, that's when the appellant moves for production of the mental health records. And in that meeting, approximately 2 months before trial, the appellant tells the court exactly why he wants to get into the mental health records of the victim. And if Your Honors look at Joint Appendix 672, that's where the appellant says 2 months before trial that he's interested in whether the victim was diagnosed or given any medication that might affect her ability to proceed. That's 672. So for 2 months, we know that the appellant's now looking for evidence that the victim had an inability or at least an alternate ability to perceive reality. Now, if we fast forward, and I think Judge Stuckey, we're talking about the Chief Judge Stuckey, pardon me, the two rounds of 513 litigation. There were two rounds, and the court can look to the first round of litigation for 513 took place from the 25 April motion, and then the military judge issued a ruling on that first round of litigation in 24 May, approximately a month before trial. That's where he ordered the unprivileged records, including diagnoses, prescriptions, and the identity of the psychotherapist, and he denied the request for in-camera review of the 513 materials. I'd like to point out, importantly,
I'll wait later, but those records were disclosed, as I'll point out in just a second. So the second round of 513 litigation took place on 14 June 2018, and that was approximately 4 days before the trial, a Thursday. The timeline is important here, Your Honor, that if you would indulge me, on the 13th of June, that's when the hospital disclosed 17 pages of records. We know that it's 17 pages because the record itself tells us that. We also know that the next morning, there was a 39A. That's the 39A where the defense called their expert to talk about these records that were disclosed. And the records, the prescriptions and the diagnoses of the victim that are at issue here, can be found at Joint Appendix 781 to 784, and also from Joint Appendix 802 to 809. Now, to your question, Judge Olson, the full appendix is not in the record. We did not find that in your record, but we do have 12 of the 17 pages that are in those pages that I just cited, Your Honor. And so in those pages, they discuss them at the 39A, and it's important what the military judge does not have at that point. He got the records just like everyone else the night before. An expert testifies, and on the record, Your Honor, that's when he ordered the defense to produce someone to, quote-unquote, decipher. I'm sorry, the government to produce someone to decipher the records. Subsequent to that, he issues his order, that the second order, to produce more documents from the hospital. And then after that, later that day, that's when each of the three parties submit their briefs to the military judge on this issue of whether he should pierce the privilege based on the stories and prescription. So after the judge has his time to review the evidence, after he receives briefing from all parties, 3 days later, that's when he issued his final decision on the 513 motion, and he denied the appellant's request to pierce the privileges. One more factual point, and I'll turn to the issues, I promise, Your Honors, and that is that if you look at that round two, as I'm calling it, of the 513 litigation that took place from 14 to 17 June, it's very important to note that that is intermingled with the continuous issue and the 513 litigation are inseparable. In fact, the first continuous motion was a motion at that 39A, the morning of 14 July, and it was just a motion for more time. The defense didn't specify how much time they wanted, and the judge said that he was denying a continuance. He wasn't going to delay the trial, but that the defense had Friday and all the weekend to continue to discuss with their expert what was in those disclosed records.
Okay.
Here, there is indication, Your Honor, in the government's brief that it could be prescribed for other, rather in the government's
Well, but wasn't there evidence from the expert that in this at this dosage, it was for psychotic symptoms?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what puzzles me. You've got this stuff floating out here, which is by all standards a powerful antipsychotic, and the government is saying she never got it because she didn't need it or whatever. And the appellant is saying we don't know whether she got it. And my question is, if she didn't exhibit any, as the judge found, she didn't exhibit any psychotic symptoms, what's the Thorazine floating around there for in the first place?
Well, Your Honor, and looking at that question in the context of the continuance issue, we would like to, of course, point out that the military judge has broad discretion in determining whether to continue or not a trial date. And when we look at the judge's
final... what I asked. I know he's got broad discretion to continue, but what's this Thorazine floating around there in the first place for? If in fact, she didn't need it, as he found, I think, or as the government's saying, that she didn't need it, she didn't exhibit any psychotic symptoms, and in fact didn't take it. Then why the devil was it prescribed?
It was, it's important, it's also in the same records that I cited for where the prescriptions and diagnoses are. It was prescribed as needed. So the fact that it was never needed, the same as the Tylenol apparently was never needed.
Well, that just kicks it back a step. It was nonetheless prescribed.
Well, in the context of the continuance, though, Your Honor, we'd like to again point to what we're looking at there. And it's with the appellant saying that there's some need to have more time to investigate the victim's ability to proceed. But throughout the entire litigation, not to mention, as the lower court did, that the appellant had lived with the victim for about a decade, there was no evidence at all that she had ever come forward and exhibited, as in the Lindstrom case that the appellant cites in his brief, any type of mental disorder that would cause her to misperceive reality. So there simply was no evidence. All there is this unfilled, untaken prescription, Your Honor. We believe that under the abuse of discretion standard, the military judge's findings of fact that Joint Appendix 821 are certainly supported in the record. And if I could, Your Honor, pivot into...
That's a specific point. The military judge says there's no evidence. And there is some evidence. I mean, the drug was prescribed for her. What do we do with this statement that there's no evidence? Does that make the finding clearly erroneous if we do that as an exaggeration? Or do we have to find that actually she did have psychotic agitation and she did take the medicine to find these findings clearly erroneous?
So, Judge, I have two responses. One, the specific ruling at 821, is the specific finding, rather, was that there was no evidence that the victim experienced psychotic agitation. I would point also that the prescription was given as needed. And it was, by the record, supported that it was never needed. Also,
you know, I think Chris Smith is pointing out that, I think an inference can be drawn that if a doctor prescribes you a powerful psychotic for as needed, that means people don't just give out prescriptions unless there's some evidence that might be needed. So my point is, what if we just disagree and we think that there is some evidence, but we're looking at this finding of fact? Appellant counsel says, well, it's an arbitrary decision, and we just have to say it's abuse of discretion, clearly erroneous. What is your position on that? If we think that there is some evidence, what do we do? Your position would be those findings are correct. What standard do we look at on that?
If the findings are incorrect, Your Honor?
Well, no. If we disagree with the preface where he says there's no evidence, but we still have the conclusion, he says, his finding, and the appellant agrees with this, that she did not have psychotic agitation and she did not take the drugs. Those were his findings, but we disagree with the fact that there was no contrary evidence. Does that make his findings clearly erroneous?
If he said no evidence and the court disagrees with that, then the record doesn't support that, despite our argument to the contrary, that would make that finding of fact clearly erroneous. And to the extent that the court found that that was an error, we would still point to that the prejudice analysis that, again, there is no evidence in the record that she ever had any ability or problems perceiving reality. There were arguments made, as we briefed, that she lied to people, that she had a motive to fabricate, but that was all fully examined at trial. But there was nothing in the record, again, that to tack on to the prescription, the unfilled prescription, that showed that she had an inability to proceed. And the first reason I could turn briefly to the 513 issue, and whether we'd like to discuss it in two parts, happy to delve deeper on either. I'd like to discuss both the appellant's rule-based argument in 513 and then the broader constitutional argument that he briefs. The rule-based argument, as issue two explicitly says, is that the military judge erred by denying in-camera review of the victim's mental health records. And our position, and I think it's fair to say appellant agrees, looking at his reply brief at 8, is that the military judge never had that authority in the first place. And that's because Congress removed 513d8 from the constitutional exception in the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act, coupled with the plain language of 513e3 that requires at least the possibility that an enumerated exception applies.
On that point, the medical records may contain some privileged material and some non-privileged material. As I understand it, the privileged material is only communications about with the psychotherapist for the purpose of diagnosis and treatment. But things that are not communications, like prescriptions, and medical records, and the temperature, and everything else that might be in those records, those are not privileged, and you wouldn't need an exception to the privilege to get those things. So those records may have some privileged information, but they also might have a lot of unprivileged information. And I think the appellant's position is you have to look at that to see if there was unprivileged information in those records that could be divulged, and you wouldn't have to find an exception for privileged information.
So a couple of points, Ron. There is a circuit split on whether that is unpublished or not, the prescriptions, the diagnoses. In this case, it's no moment. Those were given to the appellant. So given that information, Your Honor, we still have the operation of a privilege, of the psychotherapist privilege, to look at when assessing whether there is a right to pierce that privilege. And to do that, that gets to the broader constitutional question, which is, did 513 operate to as applied to appellant's case unconstitutionally? And our answer is no, and that's because when we looked at the Shepherd test, we can see that the rule itself is not arbitrary. So Afiathan takes care of that for us. And it's not disproportionate because, Your Honor, it doesn't infringe on a weighty interest of the accused. Now, it's important to look at the similar cases that are cited in this space, Brock, Chambers, and Washington. Each of those cases, Your Honor, dealt with an appellant who was deprived of the evidence that was fundamental to his trial. In one, the appellant was denied the opportunity to testify on his own behalf. And in the other two cases, he was denied the ability to call an exculpatory witness, someone who had said they had done the crime for which the appellant was being tried in those cases. Here, at best, appellant is arguing that there was cross-examination information. At the end of this discovery process, there would have been some information potentially that he could have cross-examined the appellant on. But we know from the Supreme Court in Ritchie, Your Honor, that the Constitution guarantees an opportunity to cross-examine, but not to cross-examine in any way that is effective or in whatever way, to whatever extent the defense might want. And that's, at best, that's what we have here, is that the appellant, if we assume that there was something in the record that would allow him to cross-examine her, there's nothing else in the record that says it would have been effective cross-examination, and that constitutional right doesn't rise to the weighty interest that the Shepherd Court was contemplating when discussing when a constitutional right overrides a rule-based right. But I would like to make something very clear for the Court, and that is what we are not arguing today is that Rule 513, or any other rule for that matter, can permissibly deprive an appellant of their constitutional right to defense. It can't. What we are saying, though, is that when Congress removed 513d8, the constitutional exception from the rule, it removed the military judge's ability to grant in-camera review absent applicability of an enumerated exception.
Absent what?
Absent an enumerated exception, Chief Judge.
Where do you get that from that? Where do you get that from Congress's action in cutting out the constitutional provision?
Yes, Your Honor. We cite in our brief the specific provision of the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act, when Congress orders the President to do two things, among others. One, remove the constitutional exception, and then it describes when a military judge may order in-camera review of otherwise privileged materials. And it says only when an enumerated exception applies. Appellant, important in this case, appellant has never argued that an enumerated exception applies in this case.
So now we're back with, it's the Constitution, but it's not.
So it's a constitutional question if as applied 513 was deprived the appellant of a meaningful opportunity to present a defense.
Well, in a situation like this, how can not being able to get at this stuff not deprive him of a meaningful opportunity?
Your Honor, if I could take a couple of
cases. Take what time you need.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe, we point the Court to a couple of cases that we believe are instructive here. In our supplemental citation that we filed this past week, there's a Seventh Circuit case of Malinowski. That's a similar case that applied the Shepherd test that we're advocating today as the appropriate test here. And also, that dealt with a stepfather that had sexually abused his stepdaughter and wanted to get information from the school counselor that he said, in that case, would be useful to show that she had an inability to perceive reality correctly. So, strikingly similar facts, the Court, in applying the Shepherd test, came to the conclusion that the denial of that school counselor's testimony in Malinowski did not deprive the appellant of his constitutional right to present a defense. And then also we would distinguish the Lindstrom case that appellant cites in his opening brief, not saying that that would necessarily come out differently, but we do know that it's a lot closer because in that case, Chief Judge, the appellant was able to present information from public sources that not only had the witness in question there experience hallucinations and schizophrenia, but also that she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So there's evidence supporting at least this notion. I'm not saying that would be enough under Shepherd, but it's a lot closer than what we have here, Your Honor.
I'm just curious about the distinction you're drawing here. Do you think by amending the rule that Congress took away the military judge's authority as an Article I adjudicator to make a constitutional determination and decide that the evidence had to be what the Constitution demanded that it be reviewed, even though it didn't fit in one of the enumerated exceptions? Is that what you're saying? That, of course, an Article III court could say the statute's wrong, the Constitution demands it. Are you saying because the military judge is an Article I adjudicator, he only has the authority that Congress gives him, they stripped him of his authority to make that determination?
So, no to the initial question, Judge Hardy, if I could briefly clarify our position. The military judge is limited to the authority Congress gives him or her, but here, taking away the enumerated exception only took away a military judge's ability to grant in-camera review of otherwise privileged communications. But importantly, Judge Hardy, what it did not do is take away a military judge's ability to grant other remedies. And we briefed that at the last part of our brief. If, after going through the Shepherd test, and we think it's important that this court holds that that's the appropriate test when someone is challenging a privilege absent an enumerated exception, that if, after going through the Shepherd test, and the military judge determines that the Constitution compels or requires the otherwise privileged information, Your Honor, then he cannot order in-camera review, but two things can happen effectively. One, the victim at that point could decide to waive for the limited purposes of in-camera review. If he or she didn't, then the military judge could apply any of the other remedies that are existing in the NCM, up to and including dismissal with prejudice if the case called for that. But it would be a military judge's call on what the appropriate remedy is. They certainly have the authority to do that. That's a point that we disagree with the amicus in their brief, Your Honor. Continued, any further questions?
Thank you,
Counselor. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I would just like to start by responding to the government's claim that there was only two medications that he took. The parties on the trial counsel and the victim's legal counsel even seemed to concede that she may have taken the medication. So I would just invite this court to JA 637. That's where the trial counsel says this was a summary of everything she had. And then JA 643, victim's legal counsel says, in essence, well, yes, Your Honor, she may have taken it, but it was probably given an error and it was discontinued. At any rate, it was discontinued. And so it kind of gets to Judge Hardy and Judge Olson, your questions about what would a continuance have done here. You know, we're looking at these records here. The defense needed more time at a minimum. I mean, if you have the parties at trial saying, she may have actually taken this, but we don't know, I mean, you can't, as a military judge, say that there's no evidence she took this. And I think, Judge Magg, that kind of answers the question I was making, the point I was making earlier in response to your question. That he took it upon himself, in the face of this evidence, to arbitrarily conclude something that did not happen, even though it was right in front of him. I wanted to also respond briefly to prejudice, which is that the government really did experience an unfair windfall on this mental health question, because the appellant was not able to question the complaining witness on the mental health issue at trial. And in fact, to the contrary, the government was able to call its expert to explain, children commonly forget details of these incidents. So it's true that he cross-examined her on this, but it wasn't anything that rose to the level. The theory that he was prevented from presenting at trial needed to be that mental health may have contributed to these allegations, and that was something that he was not able to do. And then just finally, Your Honor, the government concedes in its answer that RCM 703 F2 would be a remedy that would apply in this case in the absence of anything under 513. And we would just invite this court to look at that rule. That seems to be the president's indication that even if there's another rule that says there's no compulsory process of this evidence, that in the past this court has said that rule evidences the president's intent to sometimes go above and ensure a fair trial. And pending any other questions, Your Honor.
Can I ask a question? Could you respond to the government's argument with respect to in-camera review? That the government basically says, look, you can't do in-camera review because it's all privileged and it wouldn't come in anyway, and that you haven't shown any exception that would apply.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, Your Honor, to respond to Your Honor's point to that, which is that there is going to be unprivileged information in here inevitably. You mentioned the temperature and so forth, and that's correct. So in-camera review, and this is why in our brief we invited the court's attention to past decisions of this court that have looked to the RCM 701G in particular, and also 703, where even if there was some
bar to this evidence, right, under 513, even if this court were to interpret that as the defense can't conduct an in-camera review under this rule, it's not true that there's no possible way to conduct in-camera review to ensure a fair trial in this case. Because as Your Honor points out, and this goes to Judge Hardy's question earlier, it's not the case that everything in the records would have been privileged. Diagnoses, this military judge in particular found it relevant and necessary and not privileged for the defense to be able to discover the diagnoses and also the prescription medication. And so it is our position, not to speak out of both sides of our mouth, Your Honor, that the military judge didn't have authority to disregard 513 and order an in-camera review, because it does seem to indicate that, you know, if the president removed that, Congress told him to do so. But our point here is that, as J.M. versus Peyton O'Brien stressed, that's not the end of the matter. And we don't even need to get into the constitutional question on this, because we have 701, 703 in place, don't exist in the civilian world. And this is where amicus, I think, misses the mark, respectfully, that we do have a different discovery system in the military that essentially allows for this evidence, irrespective of the change to 513. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 10:45.